Ladies and gentlemen, you are now entering the Second Print Comics Podcast, starring Mark Clare and Rimzo Martini.
Folks, welcome back to another episode of Second Print Comics. This week, we are bringing you friend of the show, fan favorite, comic book creator and artist, Matt Battaglia. Matt, it has been far too long. How goes life?
Good. We moved recently. I have a new baby. I have a new book. Things are going pretty well.
I'm
so happy to be back. Yeah, a lot of newness. I'm happy to be back. Happy to talk to you. I can't complain, really.
Well, that's always a good position to be in. Mm-hmm. Matt, you've got a brand new book that's currently available for pre-order on Amazon, House on Fire. Folks, I will go ahead and leave a link in the show notes so you can go ahead and pre-order your copy like I did as soon as the show is over, or during it if you're a multitasker like some of you claim to be. I'm still waiting for a lot of those 5-star reviews, but I'll leave it at that. Matt, I've been a collector of your books going back to Indoctrination in 2015, 2016. And I gotta say, I thought I had an idea for what House on Fire was going to be, because a lot of your work in the past has usually been in like this crime, realist structure. And, you know, with the art style, like, you've established a Battaglia style that when people mm-hmm. see it, they know it if they know your work. This was different. And I say that in all the best ways. For House on Fire, and we'll get into a few of the questions in a moment, but let me just say mm-hmm. this. House on Fire, as I was reading through it, it's about 100 pages, folks.
Yep.
And this is the first book that you actually wrote yourself and you did the artwork for. So that also kind of stood out. But like mm-hmm. you do comics now the way that James Mangold does movies.
Oh, I appreciate
and,
that.
And I say that in the best way, because it took me back for a moment. I'm like, this is not the regular stuff Matt usually does, but it was just really freaking good. So let's just start here. Tell us a little bit about the story. What was, what was kind of like the origin story before? Did you always have, mm-hmm. this structure in mind? Did you always know where you wanted to go with it? Was it something that recently came about? Let's go ahead and start from there.
One, I appreciate all the compliments. It means a lot to me. The book started in May 2020. And I actually ended up doing like 3 different drafts of it. And really making the book was my way of sort of processing the past sort of 2 or 3 years. And I think that, my hope is that people can feel a lot of what I think everyone's kind of went through in it. But the core question of it is what do you do to help someone that you love, and how do you, what lengths are you willing to go to? And what happens when you're pushed to your limits, and, where do you, how do you survive? It's definitely like a realist piece. I guess the first draft of it was very city set. And then I kind of changed things. I went on a road trip with my dad in July 2020. We drove from Philly down to San Antonio. And it just, as you drive through the country, you kind of see this stark difference between cities and rural. And you kind of think of that whole divide. And that was that kind of clarified the story for me. Beyond what I was originally drafting. And so it took a couple different iterations, and I stripped parts out of it and simplified until I got down to what House on Fire is. It took a little while to do it. I actually honestly wrote all the dialogue last. That was the last thing I did. I drew it and I knew what I wanted everyone to say, but I didn't put that, you know, I don't script things, if that makes sense, when I do a comic. I kind of write notes and then I lay out all the pages and I ink all the pages, and I feel like the ink is where the story really comes to life.
Yeah, I mean, I think where I found your book refreshing, and very few people out there are like this in mainstream comics. I mean, the only other person I could say understands that, even as a writer, that comic books are a visual medium first is Chip Zdarsky, who's probably been my favorite writer since he really jumped out of Image in like 2019, 2020. Zdarsky's the one that it's like, you know, he's a great writer, he's great dialogue, but he reels himself back and allows the artist to do their job.
Well, because he's also an artist, and I mean, he's a great cartoonist. So I miss him writing and drawing his own, or I miss him drawing more of his own things. I think he's one of the few cartoonists who could actually do comedy well. It's such a hard thing to do, but like Sex Criminals with Fraction, like the first few volumes of that were hysterical. And
Public Domain, which is one of his books.
I have to read that.
Oh my gosh. Like I'm behind on that. The first volume's already up, but Public Domain is the funniest comic I have read in years. And he's not doing the art for that, but he has a lot more say in that. I thought
he was drawing that.
I got confused with Batman. That's Jorge Jimenez at Batman, which is the first Batman title I think I've picked up religiously in forever. Yeah. But Public Domain, which he writes and draws, is just like the funniest book I've read in so long. But you know what I was gonna say was, like, usually I'm a critic of when artists or writers, you know, do all the work. Usually I think that, you know, your best artist or your best writer, while they can do both, there's usually something missing. Like, you know, they're so caught up in trying to make everything good that usually it kind of lapses down. I am, you know, your book succeeds at that because, being artist minded first, I mean, there's extremely little dialogue.
Yeah.
You just kind of let the page work through everything. And what I found to be, you know, different from some of your other stuff, I think it was your book Crimson that that first kind of utilized this. It's like, you know, you're only working in like three colors, like black, white, and that like blood, creepy,
orangey,
you know, blood red, orange that you're working with. So that kind of took me back as well.
Yeah. I mean, so as far as the sort of writing artist thing, like I start with the, you know, I lay the whole comic out before. Like I try to make sure it reads without any words, and that's the most important thing to me. Cause like you said, like comics are it's a visual first medium. It drives me nuts when I read a book and it's like, you know, a six panel grid and it's the same face for six panels. It's so boring. I've been reading a lot more like manga recently, and, you know, Paul Pope, there's a Paul Pope poster behind me, but is a huge influence of mine. And so he's something that he does really well is sort of takes a lot of pacing cues from both European comics and manga and sort of synthesizes the two. And that's why, like with House on Fire, like I went for a lot of sort of lower panel counts and just pages of just like, this is mood imagery. Like, I want you to sort of feel a vibe of, you know, of it. Like, one of my intentions with it, like, I don't name any of the characters because I want the reader to be able to insert some of themselves into the story. Like, I don't, comics is such like a, it's again, like to me, it's like a, it's such a collaborative medium between like the book and the reader, because there's so much like that the reader puts in between each panel, you know, and it's also the most pure expression for an artist, because you're doing, I think that there's something expressed with like just your line that you can't really put out in any other way. So I hope when people read it that they can feel something. I mean, I want it to be an emotional book. I think too frequently culture, like we're making things that are just sort of content for content's sake, and there's no meaning. And I really want to recapture meaning. And that sounds pretentious, I'm sure. But
well, I mean, I was curious going into it whether or not this was going to be a standalone book or if you were doing this to set up for something else. And while there's very little, and I won't spoil the ending, like there's very little to be assumed by the end of the book. But I mean, you have created a world in a sense. Like I had a lot of questions, and you know, like you said, you're putting things in the story that I was applying meaning to. Mm-hmm. And you know, for the sake of our listeners who will go ahead and pick up a copy, I don't want to say anything that will taint too much. But here's the general story. This is actually pretty basic. It's a husband and a wife who live out in the country, and the wife is incredibly sick. And basically, what the husband has done in this, you know, I'll call it for lack of better terms, this post-pandemic or this post-apocalyptic world that you've set up, is he has to go into a quarantine city to basically do an exchange between him and this black market dealer. And during the exchange, shit goes down, he gets robbed, shit gets worse, and basically towards the third act of the book, that's where you're dealing with a more internal, personal crisis that will lay into how the story ends. And, you know, while that might sound basic, folks, there's a lot that's going on in the panel work that you have to see, because it's just, you know, while that is the story, there's a lot that's happening that you're seeing throughout that's creating this world, that's creating this character of, you know, as I called him, the husband. Mm-hmm. And, you know, first off, there's so many, you know, it's ironic this is coming around the same time as The Last of Us, which is I buy video games for the stories these days. I'm not even really good at them. I don't really play them. So yeah, I'm happy. Yeah. Like I'm happy to see, especially Pedro Pascal. You know, I'm happy to see him as Joel in The Last of Us. But it's like, you know, while a lot of it seems familiar, you take certain elements of things that we have had to deal with post 2020. And you apply it in the book, but even though it's like, yeah, I see that, I remember that moment for some things, it just comes up harsher. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to get too melodramatic, but, you know, Second Print Comics started in the pandemic as a result to a lack of content, as a result to a reaction in which, you know, while the elites and the studios and everyone else are not going to deliver content, while you're just going to go ahead and just get drowned of fear porn and everything else, we will go ahead and be the place where you could bullshit with your friends and talk about comic books. So, you know, reading this in a way, it kind of brought me back to that period. And the other thing is, and you know, I totally agree with you, whoever is reading this is going to come at it and take away very different things depending on who they are as individuals. I can firmly say that if I read this story a year ago, I would have extremely different thoughts than I am having read it now, having already been married for almost a year.
Yeah.
And that is what actually kind of hit me, because I was thinking about it from like, you know, well, people who are not married understand this, or maybe people who have had to take care of, you know, loved ones, you know, what is the separation between the lengths you will go for the people you love. And while that might sound like, you know, a pejorative statement, like, of course I'll do anything for the ones I love, as your character learns, that takes on a very real fucking price towards the end. And, you know, that was heartbreaking to see.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I'm so glad that you sort of you're able to more concisely explain it than I can. Yeah, you know, it's funny because you're right. Like the plot is simple, but it's one of those things with comics where it's like plot is only one sort of small piece of it. I'm so glad that you were able to pull out all sorts of things for yourself. And you know, making the book was the only way that I think I could process the pandemic. I can't make any bones about it. Like it's very much a pandemic book. I mean, it's what I did over my COVID and artistically to just figure out the world and like, what are my fears? What am I worried about? What keeps me awake at night? And, it, it shocks me that we haven't seen more art based on this or more art coming out of it. I remember, you know, especially in comics, because it's such an immediate medium in some ways, you know, I remember when 9/11 happened and the amount of comics responding to and sort of trying to process 9/11 was insane.
You had two types of reactions. You had like the Dark Knight Strikes Again, where Miller is creating a 9/11 for himself. And then you have like a John Romita Jr., Joe Quesada, Spider-Man, where, you know, he is reacting to 9/11. Both the same topic, two very different approaches to it, but they all came out within, I mean, that Spider-Man 9/11 special came out within the year, and then The Dark Knight Strikes Again. Miller went ahead and rewrote parts of the book specifically to insert that.
And that, I mean, that Strikes Again, people I think have mixed reactions to it.
I'm not a fan of it overall. But it's not because he does his own 9/11 with the Batmobile.
I feel like it's aged. It's aged really well, but in a bad way, in the sense that so many of the topics have gotten worse. Like, so many of the things that he's takes on in that book topically, like, it's like, oh, all the surveillance stuff. He's correct. But I haven't seen that. I haven't seen any sort of like reckoning with the pandemic. And to me, as someone who creates stuff, I needed to do something, because otherwise, like, what else? Like, it just goes stew in my head, and that's not healthy. I mean, I live in Philly at the time, and we moved out to the burbs now, but Philly was rough. The neighborhood we live in, you know, people are still getting carjacked regularly. You know, you get home too late and you're trying to park and you might get carjacked for your troubles. So,
Brian Nichols, from the Brian Nichols Show, lived in South Philly at the time. Yeah. And it got so bad for him during the pandemic that him and his wife picked up and moved to Indiana.
Yeah. So, I mean, like, so, you know, I would never do a straight autobiography comic, because I don't think my life is that interesting, but there is certainly, and I also think that stuff is, unless if you're a humorist, I don't think it really works that well. You know, there's so much in the book that is very much born out of like reality. I just tried to dial it up a little bit to make it at least feel dystopian. Not documentary.
Yeah, I mean, the reaction we've had in terms of the stuff that can be classified as like pandemic or lockdown inspired, you know, comics, it's only been propaganda. Right. And I say that in the most explicit sense. And, you know, if Mark were here tonight, he would immediately bring up his feud with Eric Larson that resulted in Eric Larson blocking Mark, because, you know, you have Mark, who's like the only Savage Dragon fan I've ever known.
Only time I drew a Savage Dragon was for him.
Yeah, literally. Like, you will never get that request again. But in Savage Dragon, he had it so that Dragon and his children are getting the vaccine. And there's a part in one of the issues where, you know, one of the kids is like, "Dad, why do we get it? We heal." And Dragon is like, "It's to send a message." And it's like, that is worse than like the don't smoke cigarettes ads in the free comics that like Dare would give out, where Spider-Man is like, "Listen, Hobgoblin, I've got a story to tell you about bravery." And it results in a kid arguing with his dad to try and shame him and stop smoking. And it's like, shut the hell up. And I mean, that's been it all. I mean, I don't know how many get your vax, you know, report your neighbor propo comics that Marvel has come out with.
I have no idea.
And I mean, DC had the entire Justice League take place in a Black Lives Matter protest and everything. It's like, there's, you know, my thing has always been, and I try and be fair to listeners because I don't want to preach to my listeners, but the thing has always been, it's like, if a comic is good, if the story is good and authentic to itself, it is good and I will never say anything about it.
Yep.
But when it's done specifically, you know, to lecture people in a way that is just condescending and kind of, dare I say, fucked up, that's where you lose me. And what, you know, I think the one part of the book that you did that took me off guard, and it's his last line. I'm pretty sure it's his last line. So you have you know, I called him the guard. He's the guy all kitted up like something out of Fallout. As you know, as the husband is driving into the city, and they're like, they're bitching about like, well, you don't have this pass to get in, and this pass only gets you here, and you know, you need to wear your mask, and I need to take your temperature. Like a lot is happening at once. And then, you know, towards the end of their first conversation, he basically bribes him with a whole wad of cash, and the guard lets him in. Now this guy is, you know, apart from the muggers who come in to try and mug the husband later on, resulting in, you know, the big changing point in the story. I'm thinking this guy is going to fuck him over. He's he's the primary antagonist. No, because there's a line at the end where the guy is like, you know, you're late. You should have gotten here sooner, but whatever. Yeah. You paid my energy bill for a week. As soon as he said that, I'm like, you're not a big villain. You're just a fucking puppet. Like, oh my gosh, like underneath that is a dude who, despite enforcing all this bullshit, still has to pay his bills. And as soon as I read that, I'm like, holy shit, didn't really see that. I didn't, like, now my whole perception of him is entirely different.
Yeah. Well, because you got to think about motivations, right? I mean, that's the whole thing is what are people motivated by? And your low level enforcer, bureaucrat, whatever, I don't think they're motivated because they're doing a job and they're going to follow the order rules because there's no critical thinking. I mean, you think about basically any sort of customer service thing that you deal with, you always have to escalate or whatever. Like the low person on the totem pole doesn't actually give a shit. They're just following their checklist. And so, yeah, that was that was always kind of the intent is like, yeah, these people exist to be bribed. I mean, especially in this kind of dystopian world where, you know, bribery works, at least I think with a lot of people it does. And so, yeah, that was a throwaway line. You know, that wasn't even my, you know, I was thinking like, shit, how can I make it clear? And, or how can I, you know, how do I acknowledge that this guy, you know, all this stuff. And it's like,
okay, no, that's the one that right there is what stuck out to me more than any other dialogue in the entire book. When he's like, you're late, you're really pushing it, but whatever, you paid my energy bill. And that's not spoiling anything for anybody. That's just that is my favorite line of dialogue because right there, my whole perception changed.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I don't know that you can spoil like the story. I think if you read it, you know, I think that the story is pretty, I think that there are like you said, like that moment, I think I subvert things. And then the other moment that we're going to avoid talking about, I think that there is a subversion there.
Okay. Well, you know, let's just go ahead and I want to talk about this. Yeah. So I'm going to give people a warning. If you want to read it raw for the first time, go ahead and pre-order it, then come back and listen to this. Cause now I'm about to really bring up the part where I was
going
to
spoil the plot.
What the fuck happened. Okay. So, okay. Everyone who doesn't want to hear this is gone.
Mm-hmm.
Does he fucking set? Does he kill his wife?
No.
This is where I was confused. Like when he's like, you know, so basically, as he's in the city after he bribes the guard, he goes and he exchanges a cooler full of steaks for what I can only assume is like, you know, is an oxygen tank or something for his wife. And as he's delivering that back to his car, he gets mugged by two teens. He has a gun on him. He refuses to kill one guy. He shoots the ground and he says, run. But then his partner's just like, nah, this ain't happening. So he attacks him and he shoots the kid. And then he dumps his body in a garbage barge. And then as he drives back, he has that interaction because the guy gave him like 3 hours to take care of this. And then as he goes home, you know, he hooks his wife who's on a respirator or, you know, oxygen mask to this thing. And she seems to be good. But then as they're lying in bed towards the last couple pages and he goes outside, it's like – and maybe I'm reading too much into this. But when they're in bed – he has some shading. He has some of that, you know, orange mm-hmm. shading to him. I took that as he's alive and his wife has none of it. I took that as she's
This reading is a completely new reading. I've never heard okay. this one.
Yeah. Am I wrong about that?
You can be right about it if that's what you think.
No, that's not what I want to hear. Is she alive in that panel?
Yeah, I mean, it might. So that last page, right, is for me, it's a metaphor. I've found that a lot of people who are super comic book people keep taking it literally. But you know, to me, the ending of the book is that everything's, this is just feels like we're stuck on a cycle. And I the way that I formed the story in the book is I was thinking like, what's like, you know, 10 more times around the stupid, you know, the 2020 clock, like, where do we end up? Let's do this a few more times. Like, where are we going to end up? And that was that's where I came up with it. That's where I kind of thought of the idea. Like, it's just, things are just going to get a little bit worse and a little bit worse and a little bit worse. And so at the end, you know, he goes outside and now he's the one coughing and it's like, mm-hmm. it just got a little bit worse again.
So maybe it's because, so maybe it's because I read it in a, you know, in like a PDF format.
Yeah.
So is that, what was the last page, the house on fire, or was that, okay. Why? He's already been through so much.
So it's funny. So so originally the book ended.
So she was dead in bed.
No. Originally the book ended on that splash page of his face. And you know, looking down after he says the our Father, and he ends at the he can't get past forgive us, you know?
Yeah.
And I was talking with my dad about it, and my dad was like, you know, everything you have in the book, it's sort of like a cycle. Like, shouldn't he just get sick at the end? And it's sort of like, I was like, you know, that's actually a good idea, Dad. And it makes a lot of sense. So I added him, you know, he's getting up, he's going to go back in the house, and then he coughs, and sort of the final page is that, you know, the house is not in again, like, this can be a Sopranos thing too. Like, I kind of
just kind of cuts to black.
It's, you know.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
Yeah. I wasn't going to cut it to black. I wanted to show you the house on fire. That's my intent, is sort of, it's a metaphor, is that, you know, it just, things got a little bit
I took that
worse.
Very literally. I thought, I'm looking at that. I'm like, oh my God, he killed his wife. He's sick. He's suicidal because he killed that guy. He's just going to be like, fuck it. No one gets the house. I hate everybody. I was very like, damn, that escalated fast.
My intent is a metaphor. I know that I think that I've gotten some advanced Goodreads reviews that one guy did not care for that at all.
I've been reading, because I hate myself, Tom Taylor's Superman Son of Kal-El, where everything is just blatantly told to you and there is no room. So maybe it's because I'm held back from that, where when I saw that, I'm like, damn, that was like the end of The Mist, the Stephen King story.
Oh yeah, where he shoots everybody.
Yeah, and I'm just, and then the National Guard pulls up the flamethrowers, and he's like, no! Yeah, like, that's where I was like, I was in
that
same
position.
That was a gut-wrenching
ending. No, I've also gotten people who were like, did the guy who sold him the drugs actually just sell him a bomb? And I was like, I don't know, sure, if you want to think that. To me, it's a metaphor. But if you would like to take it any other way, that's perfectly fine. For the other thing that I was always, I kept thinking about is it's like, you know, he's giving her the shot and he's hoping it works. And it's like, who knows?
she dies suddenly.
Who knows? And that's, you know, I'm sure it's going to frustrate some people. But you know, that's okay with me. I want people to read it and like, you can, I don't know, come to your own conclusions about what you want to think of it. You know, what do you want to take away from it? You know, I think that the guy has a conscience, like the husband has a conscience, and it's why, you know, he didn't want to kill any, didn't want to kill the guys that he mugged him, because, you know, do you really want that? Do you really need that? You know, that running in your head too, you know, he was trying to get out, with as little trouble as possible. And there's a point where you can't avoid it.
This was a personal thing for me. And this is what I actually found to be very ironic when I opened the file that had the pages in it. There's that, I think you pulled that quote from Ephesians, which is, I'm going to butcher it, but it's like, we deal not in the, you know, in the flesh, but we deal with principalities of power. I think you pulled another translation of it. That was, without getting into too much detail, that was something that I recited to myself quite a bit over the last 4 months, where dealing with, you know, as listeners will know, a lot of stuff was going on with me personally. And as I was kind of reciting that to myself, you know, we deal not in the flesh and blood, but in principalities of power. It's one of those situations where it's like, you try and respond to things. And I think this is really kind of the moment where I felt like, oh yeah, like this is something like I, as a husband, really connect to. You will do anything for your wife. You will do anything for that person, but will the things that you do come at a cost despite your intentions? And going into the book, that's where I was kind of looking at it. And I'm just like, you know, this hits a bit deeper for me now than I think this would have hit if I was still a bachelor or something.
Yeah.
And I think that's actually, I think that's actually something that's going to give this book a lot of longevity, and people will pick this up to just look at it, you know, over the years once they get a copy, because I think over time it will highlight different things about the reader's interpretation more so than just if you had just been very explicit about a lot of the details. Yeah. And I think it will age as the reader ages, much like any good book does.
That's what I hope. I mean, that's, you know, with this one, and you know, I've been thinking about like, why make a comic? You know, what's the point? It's not like, you know, it's a tough market, etc. They take a while to do, especially if you're doing it all yourself. You know, it's tough. And it's like, well, I want to say something, and I think that this is an important thing to say, and this is something that hopefully, you know, people can respond to. Like, I think about the sort of the best comics and books that I've read, and it's like, yeah, they do grow with you in a way, depending on when you encounter them. And then when you re-encounter them, you think about your favorite albums. It's the same way with music, where it's like, you know, it means one thing to you when you're a certain age, and then it means a whole other thing 10 years later. So yeah, I mean, I wouldn't have made this book if I wasn't, you know, wasn't married and didn't have like things that I, you know, responsibilities, I guess. Like, it just, you know, like I would like to make a straight ahead action book at some point again, but I just don't have anything there. Like, you know, I don't want, you know, I can't fake it anymore. You know what I mean? Like, it's hard to.
All the other characters you've done have always been like, there was the one book you did, Leap M. Like, they're all action. Like, you know, you had kind of a trope going for a while. Not that that's a bad thing, but that's just kind of how it was. You know, just reading and seeing the story of the husband, he's not a badass. He hasn't, like, I don't think he was like ex special forces or something.
No.
And, you know, all your other characters would have shot both the guys, spat yes. on them, yeah. driven out, killed yeah. the guard, got your money back, and then driven yes. off an explosion. Yeah. None yeah. of that happens here. No. And you feel the fear, because especially when he's looking down and then he's like, fuck, like, I got to go dispose of this body.
Right.
Like, this is dreadful. Like, this is just an average guy trying to do something that is simple, and everything just goes off the hinges. It's like you know, my favorite character in television in recent years is Marty Bird from Ozark. And you know, I'm kind of reading him as like a Jason Bateman character. Like, this guy is not a threat to anybody. Yeah. But you push a good person enough ways, and you know what happens, man. Like, you wanted to rob him. Well, guess what? Now you're dead. Like,
right.
You know, and this is him. This is a good, you know, moral person trying to contemplate that, because even though what he did in my mind is justified, I know some people might be like, well, he could have shot him in the knee or something.
It's you're not doing that.
That fight happens fast. And yes. he just does what anybody would have done. And then he's just like, shit, what do I do now?
Yep. Yeah. And I think that all that. So the personal, like, sort of link here is that, when we were still living in Fishtown, I got jumped getting out of my car. And so, you know, and basically all that happens is I got sucker punched from behind. And then they ran away because my car was locked. And I was thinking, you know, like in the action movie, the guy turns around and he gets to shoot him and whatever, and you get into a big fight. In reality, it's you don't know what's coming. and you know, shit happens, and you're like, well, that fuck. and I fixated on, like, man, I'd love to go kill those guys. And I'm like, thinking, that doesn't fix anything. Or, like, that doesn't change anything, you know, it sort of, and then do I need that? Like, and then you're thinking, like, shit, then there's going to be a whole family of people that probably are going to be out for me for a while. Like, you know, like, you know, your brain fantasizes about all this justice and revenge and stuff. And then you're like, I don't know. You try to kind of, like, so doing the book and make, like, the, you know, I that was sort of my way of kind of processing that bit, because yeah, you think about it and it's like, well, you know, and then you'd think, like, I was thinking too, like, what if you get caught, because then you're screwed.
In my last book, I in my last book, How to Succeed in Politics and Other Forms of Devil Worship, I based one of the antagonists off an old boss I had. And mm-hmm. while me and him have actually, like, gone our separate ways and we run into each other and, you know, now we're cordial now, I mm-hmm. remembered at the time of writing how much pain and anger he caused me. And, you know, in the book, I have him get hit by a semi truck.
Yeah.
And it was really cathartic in that moment.
Uh-huh.
And then I was like, if this man had actually been, you know, hit by a semi truck in the situation, how would that make me feel? And then it's just kind of like, you know, maybe it's better to just forgive him and move on.
Yeah. Yeah.
I also have him get sucker punched in the book. I do a lot of mean shit to him in the uh-huh. book. And by the end, he actually becomes a somewhat sympathetic character because the protagonist gets more jaded. But, you know, I totally get where you're coming from with that. And I mean, that's the thing about it. Like, nobody wins.
No.
Nobody wins. And uh-huh. that's the, you know, that's just how it is sometimes. And, you know, in dealing with that quote from Ephesians, it's like, you know, you could deal with the here and now, but then what do you carry with you afterwards? That's what's ultimately gonna, you know, make things better or worse for you.
Yep. Yeah. And I mean, I was, you know, I'm a, you know, Catholic, so I suffer from immense amounts of guilt. So I tried to put that into the book a bit too, just because it's, it's just something that you think about. I just, you know, I feel like, you know, for me with this and with making comics, it was just, you may as well make something that's personal and that matters and means, you know, is important to you. And so, yeah, it's a, The other thing that I worried about, so I read my publisher published the book, The Strange Death of Alex Raymond, right? And the book posits it's Dave Sim and Carson Grubaugh. And so it's Sim kind of investigating the death of cartoonist Alex Raymond. And he posits a lot of the sort of comics metaphysical sort of manifestations, right? Where these guys were drawing comic strips and, you know, ties these comic strips to events in their lives and how like, oh, they kind of manifested this thing. And so like, I was reading that while also making the book and I was bugging out about what I was going to manifest on myself by making the book.
Well, that just took a different turn.
And I had texted my publisher and cause I was going to cut the mugging. And then
the mugging jumped. Is where everything changes.
And then I got jumped. I texted Sean. I said the world just kind of like, yeah.
So that is fucking trippy.
Yeah.
Fucking wild.
Yeah. So it tripped me out. So then I was like, that's it stays.
Oh my fuck.
Yeah.
That's like divine intervention in like a weird violent way right there.
Very bad way. Yeah.
Like, don't take it out, Matt.
Where I had already manifested it. So it was like, I had already put the bad juju on myself anyways. So,
wow. So, you know, maybe it's an obvious question. Maybe it's not, but is this just a standalone story? I mean, okay. Would you ever consider, maybe not with the same characters, but maybe if the world you created, do something with it later? Has that idea popped up in your mind?
Yeah. I mean, the next thing that I was thinking about doing, is about sort of like is going to be, I think it's going to be about virtual reality and sort of the sort of constant pull for people to live inside devices basically. And it will definitely feature the same kind of cast as House on Fire in that sense. I mean, it'll be expanded a little bit. It'll be a little bit different, but you know, to me, you know, the way I'm trying to think about the projects that I want to do for myself is you know, investigating what are the things that I'm worried about, what are the things that I think about for the future, and you know, I guess what keeps me up at night, and I worry about the over. Technology taking over, especially the next generation. And, you know, so the next book I think is going to be a little bit about that. That's sort of the subject that I'm thinking about. And again, there's that pull between city and rural that is definitely going to be part of it. Cause I think that divide is just going to keep getting bigger. And so topically to me, it's like this, you know, do you live within technology or do you try to live, you know, like a real life? And, you know, you see all, you know, your intention is sucked into these sort of more and more away from reality. And so anyway, so that's going to be the core conflict of the next book in my mind. And so it can be viewed in some ways as a sequel to House on Fire, but whether there won't be a continuity, if that makes sense.
Yeah, like I was asking myself as I was reading this, because there were some similarities to your book Crimson. And for a moment, like, you know, earlier on, I was going to ask, like, is this basically in the same, you know, connected universe of Crimson? And I was like, no, Crimson was just entirely in tone. It's a completely different thing. This is very, very much a different universe. It's not connected at the same time. But, you know, to kind of cap things off, you have kind of a writer's blurb at the end where, and correct me if I'm wrong, it's where you're basically saying, you know, when my daughter reads this one day, I want her to read this as, oh, wow, this actually, you know, was this type of stuff actually happening versus, oh, yeah, this is just how things are.
Yeah.
And, you know, that's a thing that I think a lot of creatives struggle with when they take direct inspiration, you know, for their work. And I mean, for me, you know, it's hard for me to separate the fact that, you know, like for Second Print Comics, you know, this is a pandemic product at the end of the day. And while some people wish that, you know, because Mark and I will make jokes about, you know, the jab and everything else. And, you know, sometimes we'll mock characters in certain books. You know, it's not just because we like doing it. It's because, you know, we have to understand the reason, which is, you know, we can never get too jaded. We can never, you know, get too much stuff out there because at the end of the day, this is the escape valve. You know, this is the pressure valve for a lot of things. And, you know, while it's a show where we just react to dumb shit and fun shit, you know, it's never lost on us, which is why, you know, when books like this come out, you know, we're not worried about whether people say, well, that's too much of this, that's too much of this. It's like, it's either authentic to the story and to the characters and to the writer's intention, or it's not. You can't have it both ways, where it can be one thing or another. It just is the way it is. It's like, while we'll always respect, you know, Larson for being a good artist, you know, Chip Zdarsky, I have no clue about his fucking politics. You know, Tom Taylor, I think, is a lot of, you know, mean things I could say, but despite the fact that he fucked up John Kent, he's still one of my favorite writers. I mean, you can never take away like Injustice and, you know, Deceased and stuff like that, you know, and Frank Miller and more and everything else. It's like, you got to respect, you know, what the writer wanted to do, was authentic to itself. And does the story stand up against the test of, is this good itself?
Yeah. And I mean, I think again, like with that note is I just wanted to, I don't know. I feel like I needed to have something from me, the artist, in the some sort of statement in the book. I wanted some sort of note to kind of give it, I don't know, like, you know, a little bit more intent and not more intent, but like I wanted some sort of people to know that there is a human being behind it. And I think that you needed, between my note and I think with my publishers afterward, like, you, one of the things that's important, and especially the dawn of AI art, is sort of reminding people that there is an importance to human agency behind creative work. And you know, I think it's something that I wanted to reinforce. But the other thing too is like, I don't think House on Fire is a capital P political book. It is a culturally political book, possibly, but I'm not telling you anything to think. It's not prescriptive. It is simply, this is a possible future type of thing. It's, you know, low sci-fi, I guess. And what I think what frustrates me is when I read something that feels prescriptive. Or like you say, preachy, right? Where it's telling, I want to be able to come to a conclusion as a reader when I read something, and I want to try to get something out of it and learn something, but I don't, you know, especially with a creative work, I want experience. I don't want the writer to tell me how to experience it. So,
yeah, my favorite movie to say out loud, so I bug people, is Blade Runner 2049. And I mean, I love that movie. I think a lot of people hate it just because it's like 20 hours. I liked it too. And I mean, I came out of it and I remember talking to a, you know, more left-leaning friend compared to myself. And I said, you know, it's so weird. I didn't know walking in I was going to watch a pro-life movie. And he looked at me, he's like, what? And I'm like, what, you didn't come away with that? And he was like, no. And I was like, well, that's fine. I mean, you know, Blade Runner is another film that I would, you know, to use your words, it's a culturally political film that's lowercase political. And I mean, you could take a lot of things in and out of it. I mean, I think, you know, I think movies like that, that's why, you know, I don't like a lot of the Marvel movies coming out, because it's like, you know, Phase One Marvel will always be what I consider the best, but there are a lot of, you know, but there are a lot of films where it's like, you know, while I might like them, I'm not going to be watching, you know, like I'm certainly not going to be watching a lot of the stuff that's come out in the past 5-6 years, 20 years from now. But I could probably I could probably pop in Blade Runner 2049 and I will have another reason to appreciate that film. And I think that's why you know, not to drag things on too long, you know, I think that's why manga is taking over more of the comic book market, because you know, people to a degree, they want to see a conclusion for stuff. And you know, with our incessant need to constantly see shit, you know, gender bended and rebooted and, you know, retconned and everything else, it's like, you know, having a good, you know, end to a story is not a bad thing. It's an amazing thing. Yeah.
I don't like continuity for that reason, because people just obsess over it. So like, just tell something, get in, get out, and be done with it. And that's why all of the comics that people go back to, all of the books, all the movies are things that kind of can stand on their own. It's what, like you said, what worked with the phase one of Marvel is that when you went to go see Iron Man, you didn't need to know anything going in, and you didn't need to, you know, like the stinger was cute and all that, but it didn't really matter at all. All those early ones sort of like they did tie together in some ways, but they were their own thing. Whereas now it's like, well, shit, now I got to watch 20 hours worth of stuff to even figure out what the heck's going on. And on top of that, they don't mean anything. I mean, they're popcorn, which there's nothing wrong with popcorn entertainment, but like a Blade Runner for 2049 is a good way to do like the sequel reboot or rehash or whatever, because it still, it had something to say and it had some real agency about it. You know, that's what I admire, that is that like you can make something that's both entertaining, but the person who's consuming it can at least get something. I've stopped reading a lot of comics because there's just nothing, there's not a lot in them. But there's a ton of stuff in indie comics that's really great, like that you can, you know, you can walk away and be like, oh, I, you know, this is an experience that I enjoyed taking.
So is this going to be how you do things going forward? Do you plan on just, you know, coloring and drawing your own books, or would you like to kind of toss some of the work on to other people?
No, I think that, I mean, I have one book that I have to finish that someone else wrote. And after I'm done with that, everything that I do from then on is just going to be 100% solo as much as I mean, you know, this is what I'm saying right now, but I think that's what I'd like to do, because it's more fulfilling for me. And you know, it's the only way I can get things done. Like I can't, the book that I'm drawing that the other guy wrote, I think he's a good enough writer and, you know, I'm, but I can't tell you anything about the story because I can't remember any of it. Like I can look at a page of script and I can do I can thumbnail it, but I can't remember what happened before when it happens after. Like I don't have any story knowledge of it because I can't hold that information in my head. Whereas House on Fire, like I can sit there with the thumbnails and I know, like I can add pages and move pages around because I know the whole thing from beginning to end in my head. Like it's all up here and I know exactly what I want to do. And so working with other people complicates that. And also like at my work at Free the People, like I do video production. So I have to collaborate with other people, and which is fun, but like when I want to do comics, I want to do it all by myself and not have to listen to a single other soul.
I feel you. Well, Matt, if people want to go ahead and pre-order their copy right now, how long is the pre-order going until, and where can people go ahead and grab it?
It's on sale and like it's going to the printers right now. So it should be in comic shops on March 18th, and I think everywhere else on March 23rd or 25th. I'm not positive on that date. But you can buy it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble. You can buy it at Target. You can go to your local comic book shop. You know, it's available through Diamond. So if they didn't order it, you can yell at them to order copies. You can buy it directly from my publisher, Living the Line, at livingthelinebooks.com. So there's really like however you want to buy it, you can buy it. So any other bookstores, if you got like a small bookshop, they should be able to get it in for you. you know, it's available, yeah, wherever you buy books. So
awesome. And folks, I'll go ahead and leave links in the show notes of this episode today. Matt Battaglia, author, creator, writer, artist of House on Fire, thank you so much for joining the program today.
Thank you so much for having me on, and it's great. It's always great being out, talking with you, so appreciate it.
Likewise. Folks, if you went ahead and enjoyed this episode, please go ahead and leave us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Google, Stitcher, Spotify, wherever you're listening to the show, and we'll be back later in the week. Remember, if there's one thing you can do, it's as simple as ever. It's read comics and change the world. Good night, America.